It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today we are revisiting our favorite segments from 2013. We've each chosen our favorite interview of the year, and I'm joined now by Essential Pittsburgh assistant producer Heather McLean. Heather, what's your choice, and why did you choose it?
I had a number of favorites this year, but one of the conversations I found to be most compelling in 2013 was back in August. It was a discussion about children aging out of the foster care system. The guests were Helen Kalan at the Pitt School of Social Work and Christopher Nobles, who serves as a liaison between state officials and youth in the foster care system. This segment was memorable for me because of the way Christopher and Helen describe what it's like being in the foster care system. Specifically, it was the psychological impact and the challenges of feeling safe to be a kid.
What approach do you take, Christopher, in your work with some of the kids aging out of foster care?
Generally, I'll start off. I try to be a very positive influence on them. I don't really want to go to youth who are coming up behind me saying, "No, I'm an example. They need to be more like me." I try to be encouraging. I try to let them know that, you know, they're not the only story like theirs. There's a lot of help out there for them. And most of all, youth in care don't get called normal very often. Anything that happens in their life was probably due to extenuating circumstances. There's a lot of trouble they can get into. I like to go from the approach that these youth are just trying to live their lives with the hands they were dealt. And that generally gets me in the door with them pretty easily.
I don't know whose childhood is an example of normal or what, you know, what.
It's kind of subjective.
Yes, it certainly is. Having said that, however, we get the idea of what a normal childhood should be, or at least our perception of it. And in the case with the kids who are in foster care, how many challenges are there, or what kind of challenges are there that get in the way of having what we would agree is a relatively normal childhood?
I mean, it starts from the basics. Having a home base, a place to call home, a steady roof over your head, that's the first challenge. And even for youth who seem to be doing well, seem to be coping with it well, not having a place to always go back to, a place that you don't have to earn as a home, that's going to be the first hurdle. They don't have too many places that just feel secure. There are a lot of needs that need to be met so far as education. Credits get lost in high school. Moving from district to district, however many transitions you go to, trying to pursue higher education when your high school education might not have been all that great or all that complete. And the general transition into adulthood when you have a lot more responsibilities placed on you. It's not 18, go to college, learn to be in the workforce. It's 18, learn to fend for yourself, work full time, try to go to school. There are a lot of challenges, more than I could really list briefly.
Well, we'll try to get into as many as we can to help people understand what these children go through and you know, what it's like for the families in general who take in foster children. When Christopher Nobles talks about, for example, just this, you know, idea that for a lot of these children, these young adults, you're walking on eggshells, you're trying to earn your keep. What is the mindset that the foster parents go into these arrangements with, and how many of them have an idea that the situation needs to have some aspect of unconditionalness, unconditional love and acceptance? Is that something that, if not a prerequisite, how important is that to making sure that the situation works?
It's absolutely critical. And we have to keep in mind, too, that there are a variety of reasons why youth enter into foster care. Parental mental illness, substance abuse, poverty, domestic violence. There are a lot of reasons why youth require a safe and secure alternative setting. And for most foster parents, their desire is to provide that safe alternative for youth. And our job in the system is to support those foster parents and to make sure that they have the supports they need so that they are in turn able to support that youth who comes to live with them.
But the parents do have the upper hand from the standpoint that they can say at any point, this isn't working, sure. and this child, this young man or lady has to go.
Absolutely.
So with that in mind, how difficult does that make it for a child to adjust, knowing that, man, I could be out on the street or in, you know, a group home if I can't make it work? There's this sort of expectation and pressure on me.
Absolutely. And I think Chris can probably speak to that, that there's always that constant fear that this won't work out, that this will just be a temporary placement, that I don't really belong here. This is just for the time being, and that my behavior could make the difference between whether or not I have this home or whether I don't.
So there's a kind of a psychological aspect to this, isn't there, Chris, for each child in foster care?
I would definitely say there's a great deal of psychological stress. Even if everything checks out financially and the living situation, education's great. The psychological stress of – I tell people you sort of grow up having to audition for everything. Just to have a home, you have to be some sort of poster child. Now, it's not that families expect you to be perfect, but you do have to walk on eggshells. You don't want to make that one mistake that's going to get you thrown out, even if it's not the case. There's still that added stress. I get asked pretty frequently as a youth quality improvement specialist why I'm so comfortable with speaking in front of people or why I look so comfortable. I'm always nervous out of my mind, but it comes to my attention that it's because I spent a lot of time in my developmental stages auditioning and finding out how to seem presentable just to get by, just to not be bothered, just to feel like I'm going to be safe for the night, that I'm not going to be removed. So it creates a sort of a different breed of people who just become comfortable with the notion that the only way that they're going to be accepted somewhere is to put on a show.
Is it up to the parents to maybe take some of that aspect out of it, to try to be reassuring, not beyond a reasonable expectation, but to the point where a child can at least let go of that part of the stress? Because we all know childhood – adolescence Absolutely. Is stressful enough without that on top of it.
Absolutely. And we certainly work with foster parents to engage with them and help them give that message to the youth that this is a safe, secure setting and that they care about them and that they're invested in their success and their school, their education. But again, it can be challenging.
We're talking with Christopher Nobles, a youth quality improvement specialist at the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work, and also Helen Kalan, whom you just heard, principal investigator for the Child Welfare Education and Research Programs at the Pitt School of Social Work. We're looking at the issue of aging out of foster care and also the challenges. What are the programs that help young people as they age out of care?
Just to give some perspective on this, nationally there are about 25,000 youth who are aging out of the foster care system each year. And in Pennsylvania, our number is approximately 1,000 youth are aging out of foster care. Most of these youth have been in care for, on average, 17 months. They're likely to have lived in at least three or more settings. So that there are a number of challenges related to life skills training, vocational training, high school support. Some youth go on to take a GED exam. Youth have their own issues that require counseling, either group or individual. There are job placement issues, employment, housing, aftercare. So we try to address the array of issues that are there for youth so that we can help support them in having a safe, healthy move forward into independent living as adults.
And Christopher, as you approach some of these kids, having been in foster care, does that help your work with the young people that you come in contact with?
It definitely does. Just to be able to tell them, I've been there, and they hear a lot of "I've been there." I know what it's feeling like. So I've set up groups that I've been talking to ask me that question. Oh, do you really know what it's like? And then I tell them the story. Yeah, I really do. Being very close to homelessness at 18, it helps give them some perspective. And again, I don't like to present myself as some sort of success story for them because I'm just trying to get by just like the rest of them. But it is good to be able to show them, if you do the right thing, stay on the right path, find some good people, definitely find some good supportive people, you can turn out all right. You can break even and move on with your life.
When you say that you came very close to being homeless at 18, what happened?
I didn't have a foster family to go to. My biological family was obviously going to be out of the picture. Had it not been for Montgomery County's supportive housing program, there was nowhere else to put me. I wouldn't have had a home. There was nowhere for me to go. So early on during that experience, I don't think I quite caught on to how close the call was, but had I not gotten that voucher for that apartment, there was nowhere for me to go. So it was a very close brush with homelessness.
Helen, how would you describe just the whole aging out process?
The aging out process can be difficult for a youth who has spent a number of years in foster care, living with a variety of different families. And what can happen over time is that that youth can become disconnected from their own family of origin, from their siblings, from the individuals who are part of their history. And for youth that are aging out of the system, many are going into unknown circumstances, having to face living on their own, maybe not having all the skills to be able to do that, facing finding a job, finding employment, struggling with, you know, should I go on to school? Can I go on to school? Is there a place for me? And I think one of the big issues is having that sense of lifelong family connections that most of us grow up with and take for granted. But if you're a child in the foster system, you don't have that to take for granted. You don't have lifelong family connections, and you have to work extra hard to establish them.
That was assistant producer Heather McLean's pick for the most compelling conversation of 2013. Coming up, my favorite interview of the year. That's next as Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Heather McLean, the assistant producer. I'm here with Paul Guggenheimer, our host, and the tables are turned right now because today we're revisiting our favorite segments from 2013. We've each chosen our favorite interview of the year. And so, Paul, what's your choice and why'd you choose it?
Well, it was very hard because we've done a lot of interviews, hundreds of them over the past year, and it's hard to pick just one. So I don't know necessarily that I would say that this is the absolute best, but it's one that stuck out in my mind as I thought about the people that we've spoken to over the past year. Sister Helen Prejean. If that name does not ring a bell, certainly her best-selling book will, Dead Man Walking, which was on the New York Times bestseller list for 31 weeks and, of course, was turned into the major motion picture, Dead Man Walking, starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn. Sister Helen Prejean was in Pittsburgh last May for a speaking engagement at Rodef Shalom Congregation. And it was very interesting to me that here was this woman, a nun, speaking to a Jewish congregation. And she would not have been invited to do this if she did not have a very compelling message. And she makes a very strong argument against capital punishment. And one of the ways in which she does that, and what I found so riveting, is the way that she absolutely puts you on death row. You feel like you're sitting with Patrick Saunier, who is a man on death row. And she began our interview by talking about what inspired her moral and spiritual philosophy, and then got into the story of how her correspondence with Patrick Saunier began. Let's listen.
I started to be educated about human rights, that everybody has a right to live. No one should be subjected to cruel and degrading punishment or torture. And as a Catholic, traditional Catholic, it had kind of been, the state has a right to kill. I never questioned it. But when I lived among poor and struggling African Americans in the inner city in New Orleans is when I started learning everything from a different point of view. And it was when I was there working at a place called Hope House that I got this invitation to write a man. I didn't even think they were going to execute him. I didn't know much about the death penalty. I had just awakened to the issues of social justice. And because it was the early 80s, we hadn't had an execution in Louisiana in over 20 years because there'd been an unofficial moratorium starting in the 60s through the 70s. In 76, the Supreme Court put the death penalty back. I didn't notice. Didn't affect me. And then lo and behold, I write this man, I visit him, and 2 years later, I accompany him. And he looks at my face when they kill him in the electric chair. And along that road, I also met the victims' families. And at first made a very bad mistake. I stayed away from them thinking that they wouldn't want to meet the nun who was a spiritual advisor to the man who had killed their children. There were two teenagers killed in the most brutal, cold-blooded way you can imagine. They'd gone to a football game, gone to a place, a local lover's lane to park, and they are found lying dead on the grass with bullet holes in the backs of their heads, and the girl had been raped. She was Loretta Bourk. The bar was David LeBlanc. I'm drawn into this whole vortex, and I didn't think they'd want to see me because I was a spiritual advisor to Patrick Sonnier and his brother Eddie. And I made the worst possible mistake. I didn't even write him a note to say I'm so sorry about your son or daughter. They met me in the most polarized situation you can imagine, which was a pardon board hearing. The last step before Pat was to be executed, his brother had gotten a life sentence. And that's when I met them. And it was the father of David LeBlanc who came right up to me. His name is Lloyd. He said, Sister Helen, all this time you've been visiting with those two brothers and you didn't once come to see us. Sister, you can't imagine all the pressure they're putting on me for this death penalty. They all telling me that if I'm not for the death penalty, it looks like I didn't love my son David, that I got to be for the death penalty, and I haven't had anybody to talk to. And he was the first victim's family I met who began to take me through their struggles and what they go through.
How did your correspondence with Patrick Sonnier begin?
I was asked by a member of the Louisiana Coalition of Jails and Prisons if I wanted to be a pen pal with somebody on death row. So they gave me his name. I wrote him a letter. And he wrote back, and I wrote, he wrote.
What did you say in your letters?
I mean, just ordinary stuff. You know, it's just like, hi, I'm Sister Helen Prejean. I sent him a picture of myself. The only one I had was on this little pony in the woods, and I said, I'm the one with two legs. And sent him a picture of Christ on the cross, but it was too big. It didn't fit the prison. I started to learn about prison rules. That picture got ejected, but they let me through the photograph of me on the horse. And we just started corresponding. And out of his letters, because he never asked anything. I mean, he never even asked me to come or send him money for cigarettes, anything. I found out he had no one to visit him. So it kind of evolved. It was like very organic. Oh, you got nobody to visit you. Well, look, I'll come see you sometime. And then I began to come regularly because I realized he didn't have anybody else. I didn't know anything about the law or the courts or the appeals courts or the Supreme Court or how things worked. In my second book, The Death of Innocence, I know a lot about how the courts work. And I even take on Justice Scalia, some of the arguments, the way he interprets the Constitution. Because I can see on the ground the way this thing really works. And they may say it's only for the worst of the worst, the guidelines the Supreme Court gave. But you know who it is? You look on the ground, who gets it? Overwhelmingly people who kill white people. And then if it's a person of color kills a white person, well, boy, you really up 14 notches. Always poor people and geographically located in certain parts of the country. You even look at Pennsylvania. You had hot spots where DAs would go for the death penalty all the time. Right next door, DA never went for the death penalty. And so we have this sporadic, arbitrary way that it's carried out disproportionately always against poor people. The very reason, Paul, that the Supreme Court in the Furman decision of 72 overturned the death penalty, because they said it's arbitrarily and capriciously applied and disproportionately applied to poor people and minorities. It's the same today. But they stay in their theory, and they don't come down and look at the ground.
So you say that the death penalty is not only ineffective, but it's also inefficient.
Well, ineffective, inefficient, that's pretty synonymous. But it's morally wrong because, and see, what I do in my book, Dead Man Walking, is bring people close to the reality of what it actually means for the state to kill a human being, like the guards who have to do the killing for us. what happens to them. Suddenly they find themselves on the execution squad, and they got to take a live man from that cell, and they got to accompany him and strap him down. They practice in Louisiana. They practice when he goes quietly or when he fights them, and they got to kill that man that night, and they're being told, it's just your job. I tell the story of Felton Cootie, who was the supervisor of death row in Louisiana, and how after 5 executions, he called me in his office, and he said, I know their crimes. I know everybody on death row because I was the supervisor. But, boy, when you see a man's defenseless like that, and then you're part of the team of people that kills him, I come home after these executions, I can't sleep and I can't eat. So you got to tell everybody's story, including the victims' families. And I had a really good editor at Random House. In fact, we're getting ready to reissue Dead Man Walking. It's a 20-year anniversary. And we have Archbishop Tutu, who wrote the preface, and we have Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins, both wrote an afterword about what it was like to do the movie and work on the film and all together. And I did an afterword about where we are 20 years later. And my editor, Jason Epstein, and he told me, now look, you're a Catholic nun, you're a spiritual advisor to a murderer on death row who did an unspeakable crime. And if you don't talk about that crime in the first 10 pages of this book, nobody's going to read your book because they're going to think, oh, well, she's a nun and she's going to say Jesus said to forgive. They're going to expect every religious platitude in the books to come from your lips. And you got to bring people in the first 10 pages and look at that crime and the suffering of that family and then to raise a moral question. So what should we do? And then you got to take people with you step by step into the horror of what it means to take a live human being and put him to death.
How did you get past what Patrick Saunier had done? How did you get past the crime that he committed in order to see him in a human way?
It's interesting, your choice of words, how did I get past it? I never got past it. But when I'm looking in a man's eyes and I know what he did, but I was just with some Quakers, and they said, everyone has the light in them. He's more than that one act. There was also goodness in this man and remorse in this man. And everybody I discovered through him is more than the worst act of their life. But it put me in a terrible kind of ambivalence because I was always, once I'm at the victims' families and knew their sufferings, holding in my heart at the same time this fierce, well, here he is. I know he shouldn't be killed. He's a human being. But then the suffering of the victim's family. And what I've learned over these 25 years of doing this and being with victims' families, you know, sometimes you'll see there was a trial. They go for the death penalty. You see the victim's family come out with a V sign. We won. We won. He got death. And then they start waiting, 10 years, 15 years. And I've seen them along the way while they're waiting for this so-called justice that they'll get to witness. Some, very few, you know, it's less than 1% of all the people who experience homicide who are given this so-called justice. It's just pure symbolism. It's political symbolism. It's not about really stopping crime.
What do you say to people who argue that a murderer has no excuse, has taken the life of another, and therefore does not deserve to live, and someone who, as a parent, says, I cannot be at peace with this unless this man or woman dies?
That's the way most victims' families, that's usually the first thing out of their mouth. But that's not where most of them stay. Because in fact, a victim's family said that, those very words to me. Her daughter had been killed. She said, I can't stand the thought that even if he gets life without parole, he's still alive and she's dead, and that's wrong. That's unfair. I can't be at peace till I see him dead. And that's the way people start out. But then there's life, and they have other children. And that all that energy that's going in to see him dead, like Lloyd LeBlanc, the father of David, his journey is the one that I tell in most intimacy in Dead Man Walking. And the way he put it was, I was putting all my energy into wanting to see them dead and all this anger and bitterness coming into me. I wish I could pull the switch. But then I didn't like what was happening to me because I was filled with that hatred. I wanted to do to them what they did to our son. And then he said, they killed my son, but I'm not going to let them kill me. And he set his face to go down the road in love with his family and people around him so that he wouldn't lose his integrity as a person. He had always been a kind person who loved to help people. And then he saw himself losing that because he was taken over by the hatred. That's a struggle.
How does a murderer retain their humanity?
Well, I've accompanied six human beings to execution. And each of them that I have accompanied with varying degrees of consciousness about what they did. One man I was with, Willie Celestine, was on drugs. He completely blacked out the murder. He wasn't denying it. This is an hour before he's to be killed. He said, I'm not denying it, but I don't remember a thing. And the way all of them that I've been with, including him, the last words were to ask forgiveness of the victim's family. One, Robert Lee Willie, said to the family, I hope this brings you some peace. And they all said words like that and then died with as much dignity as they could muster. In The Death of Innocence, I'm with two people I believe are innocent. And with Dobie Gillis Williams, African-American man, IQ 65, railroaded this little town, Manny, Louisiana, for the killing of a white woman in her house. His last words were to the warden who was saying, Dobie, anything you want to tell me? He had disobeyed his mama. And whenever he disobeyed his mama, he got into trouble. He was out drinking with friends the night he was supposed to be home. It led to all the trouble because he was up around 11 o'clock at night, all this. That he had disobeyed his mama. He had an IQ of 65. And so he just said, I'm sorry I brought all this trouble on my mama. Those were his words to the warden. And people do the best they can. And I got to have a direct dialogue with Pope John Paul about the Catholic Church teaching and saying it's filled with loopholes and people quoting Catholic teaching to justify doing the death penalty. And I said,
an eye for an eye.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And I just said to the Pope, I said, when I'm walking with a man to execution and he's shackled hand and foot, surrounded by six guards who are going to strap him down and kill him, and he says, Sister, just pray God holds up my legs. That's the way a person tries to show their dignity, that they walk to their execution. I said, where's the dignity? Does the Catholic Church only uphold the dignity of innocent life? Well, what about guilty life?
What did the Pope say?
He changed the catechism. I wasn't the only one, of course, in dialogue, but I had a direct dialogue with him. And he changed the catechism of the Catholic Church to strengthen its opposition. And then when he came to St. Louis after that in 1999, for the first time, he put in the death penalty with the other pro-life issues that Catholics are used to hearing. No to abortion, euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide. And he said, and no to the death penalty because it's cruel. Our Supreme Court won't acknowledge torture, but he says because it's cruel and unnecessary, we have a way to keep ourselves safe without killing people. And he said even those among us who have done a terrible crime have a dignity that must not be taken from them. And then there was a move within the Catholic Church in the United States to be much more assertive in teaching and upholding. And there's been a real shift in Catholic opinion about the death penalty. In 96, 80% of Catholics believed in the death penalty. Today, it's less than 50% because of teaching, because of bringing people there and saying, what are we doing? What do the teachings of Jesus mean anyway? Why you keep quoting this eye for an eye thing? Jesus said, you've heard it said an eye for an eye, but I say to you, well, who are we as Christians? Like, are we domesticated Christianity? We all culturalize. We sound just like everybody else. And we justify taking a person, rendering them defenseless, and killing them? Why? In whose name are we doing that?
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer here on 90.5 WESA. My guest is Sister Helen Prejean, the author of Dead Man Walking. How did you embark on writing Dead Man Walking?
Well, when I came out of the execution chamber after Patrick, he was the first one. He was electrocuted to death, and I was there, and he looked at me. I came out of that execution chamber, and I threw up. It's the middle of the night, and I remember thinking, the people are never going to get close to this. They're going to hear about the crime. They're going to read the newspaper. Justice was done. He was executed, and reflection's over. I've been brought close. I got to tell the story. First, I did it with talking. Then I began to write.
You've written a second book called The Deaths of Innocence, as you mentioned, and it's an eyewitness account of wrongful executions, which details the trials and executions of two men you believed were innocent. What led you to believe that they were innocent?
Visiting them over a whole number of years, like Dobie Gillis Williams, the African-American man, it was over 10 years. Joseph O'Dell, the second story in the book, I was with less, but there was a whole group of people trying to get him to get the courts to do the testing. And that's how I found out how the courts can kill you. I learned, for example, that when you have your trial, if your lawyer does not present a formal argument of opposition of things that happened during your trial, the appeals courts won't pick up the issue later. Like Dobie, a black man in this little southern town accused of killing a white woman, he looks out at the jury of his peers, the fair and impartial jury of his peers, and it's all white people from the town. How could the Supreme Court of the United States uphold that? How they upheld it? They said, your lawyer didn't raise a formal objection to the seating of the jury, but he said I had a terrible lawyer who didn't do anything for me. Sorry. Not perfect, but that's the way it goes. And so I begin to learn all of these things. So that's accompanying people and reading and getting to know the facts over a period of time. And so it's not lightly. But, you know, I understand better structurally now why. It's almost inevitable. It is inevitable. Because, see, the place to get to the truth is during trial. And you take the Deep South states where you have an overworked, underpaid defense counsel who maybe has 100 cases, three of which are capital cases, and that's supposed to be your defense. There's no way they can prepare. There's no way they even have the adequate energy a lot of times to go up against prosecution. Who's in control of the evidence? And they have to go hat in hand to ask for money to conduct independent testing of the forensic evidence. A lot of times they just don't give them the money. So we don't have an adversarial way to come to truth, and it's slam dunk. And then the appeals courts deny it because the lawyer who was inadequate didn't raise formal objections. 142 wrongfully convicted people have come off a death row, say by college students in these innocence projects. College kids are doing it, and that shows how broken it is. So it's inevitable that some of the people who go are going to be the innocent along with the guilty, the way I see it now.
Many parts of America have the death penalty. We have the death penalty here in Pennsylvania. So what needs to happen with the death penalty, in your opinion?
There's a lot that needs to be done for victims of violent crime, a lot to be done to help them, to the shattered families. They need counseling. They lose their jobs. They need all kinds of help. And you're going to sink all the money down the hole of killing one person out of I don't know how many. And look at Pennsylvania. How long have you had the death penalty on the books? 25 years, whatever? How many people have you actually executed during all this time? Like three. And you have over 200 people sitting on death row.
So how do you get rid of it? Can we get rid of
it? Yeah, of course we can. Look, in the last 6 years, six states have put it down. Part of it is just look at the cost analysis. Wouldn't it be better to be putting this money into law enforcement with unsolved murders or people who are raped, or put it into the law enforcement in the community where it's going to help everybody instead of sinking it down the black hole. And then involving ourselves as a society. Where else in the criminal justice system do we ever say, their crime was so terrible, we're going to imitate them and we're going to do to them what they did to their victim. You kill, we're going to kill you. You know, I tell the story in Dead Man Walking, Faltus Cootie. He was the supervisor on death row in Louisiana. And after five executions, he called me in. He goes, sister, I'm not going to be able to keep doing this. I can't eat. I can't sleep. Because in my gut, I know I'm being involved in killing somebody who's been rendered defenseless. And, you know, I push people in the audience when I'm bringing them there close to this on both sides and just say, when we're outraged over crime and we say they ought to die, well, could you do it? Could you be the one personally to do it? Or you got to hire somebody to do it for you and you don't want to be anywhere near it? And most people go, well, I don't know if I could do it. When people are in a state of rage, they say, oh, yeah, I could do it. But really, when it comes down to it, you know what they have to put on the death certificate after an execution, cause of death? You know what they have to write?
What do they write?
Homicide. Because it means a human being killing another human being. Now, Texas puts legal homicide by way of execution. But the key word is homicide. And look how bankrupt that is morally, that the only thing we can think to do with people who kill is to kill them.
My guest has been Sister Helen Prejean. She is the author of Dead Man Walking. She has written a second book called The Deaths of Innocence, An Eyewitness Account of Wrongful Execution. Sister Helen, it's been a pleasure having
Paul,
you.
Paul, great to talk to you. Thank you.
We'll continue with more Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and today we are revisiting our favorite segments from 2013. I'm joined now by Essential Pittsburgh producer Marcus Charleston. Marcus, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
Now, we have selected different segments. We've each chosen our favorite of the year. You have made a choice. What is it, and why did you choose it?
It's a segment called A Tale of Two Theaters, which aired originally in April. I wanted to show the importance of small town theaters to the towns that they're in and the boost that they can give to the economy. So we looked at the Palace Theater in Greensburg and the Roxian Theater in McKees Rocks. The segment opens up with an essay by Greg Joseph, the bass player for the rock group The Clarks. He's played in a number of these theaters, and this is what he had to say in an essay.
All across the USA, long-ignored Main Street theaters lie in a state of restoration purgatory. Can America save its withering social treasures? I've had the opportunity to play in theaters in small towns and big cities across America, and it always brings a sense of excitement. The moment of truth happens when arriving at the venue for the first time and seeing the condition of the theater. The smell of history, the feel, imagining the vibe the year it was built. Red velour, gold leaf trim, black and white tile floors with tons of marble resting on top of it. That's what I hope to see. But it usually isn't that way. Main streets have been dying, and as Main Street goes, so go the theaters. So how do we restore these treasured dinosaurs? First, neighborhood civic organizations or local philanthropists need to step up and get the energy behind a restoration idea started. It takes a lot of money and some questions. To what extent can the theater be restored? Can they afford a complete restoration of the facility down to the last painted cherub on the ceiling? That's the perfect and somewhat straightforward architectural solution. Ever been to the Warner Theater in Erie, PA? It is gorgeous. But I also love to see buildings that have been transformed by creativity for a different functionality. In a Washington, D.C. area movie house many years back, I went to see a first-run film. What a thrill it was to walk into the seating area and discover lounge chairs, couches, and cocktail tables instead of thinly padded plastic seats with numbers. Bar food, cocktails, and waitresses made the experience better than the movie, whichever one it was. Repurposing? I hate that buzzword, but in this case, It works well. Take a look at The Strand in Zelianople, PA, the Lincoln Theater in Raleigh, North Carolina, the Magic Bag in Detroit, Michigan, or the Visualite Theater in Charlotte, North Carolina. Step 1, money. Check. Step 2, now what do we do with it? The answer lies in recent success stories and a creative board of directors or owner. Leaving entertainment decisions up to an aged community support group won't get you very far. The theater needs to energetically move forward, not be nostalgic about the past. It takes the imagination of artists, actors, musicians, and promoters to figure out how to market the facility. The Palace Theater in Greensburg is a great example of how to fill seats with quality shows. Step 3, help rebuild Main Street, too. When the bills are paid and the shows are flowing, how do you make your patrons feel like they're attending not just a show, but an event? That's where the local theater must work with Main Street to bring guests in for dinner and an after-show dessert and coffee in a safe neighborhood. I love walking in small-town America and searching around for the unique in America. And when I come upon that theater marquee, my sense of curiosity wants to know a little more about what lies beyond that old ticket window speaker.
An essay by Greg Joseph, guitarist and songwriter for the rock band The Clarks. One of the theaters mentioned in Greg's essay was the Palace Theater in Greensburg. Joining me in studio now are Mike Langer, president of the Westmoreland Cultural Trust, and Taras Virchek, executive director of the McKees Rocks Community Development Corporation. Gentlemen, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to be here.
Mike, let me start with you. The Palace Theater was mentioned in the essay. What impact has the theater had on the economy of Greensburg?
Well, specific to that, whenever you bring in, and we've been averaging about 60,000 folks a year that come through the Palace Theater, we draw from a tri-state area. We had an economic impact study done by Mullen and Lonergan Associates in the north side here in Pittsburgh, and they came up with the number of $7.1 million per year to the local economy. And that's a huge number. So, you know, when you add $7 million to all of the hotels, the restaurants, the stores, everything like that. And what anecdotally, in 2002, there was one restaurant in downtown Greensburg. There are five now. The stores that have opened up as a result of it, Seton Hill University put their performing arts center. A theater is the nucleus to build around it. And the entire economy in all directions will benefit as a result of it. We've seen that in Greensburg.
Taras, what effect do you hope restoration of the Roxian will have on the community of McKees Rocks?
Well, Mike touched on a lot of those elements, and in our case, we're really looking for the Roxian to be a catalyst for development on Lower Chartiers Avenue. Lower Chartiers is a compact collection of early 20th century buildings, fantastic architecture, State Route 51, 20,000 vehicles a day pass by. And across the street from the Roxian, we have the lovely Father Ryan Arts Center, which is a magnificent arts education and performance venue. So we have the pieces, so to speak. And again, the missing piece of that puzzle, we really feel, is the Roxian, that destination that brings thousands to your downtown on a monthly basis and then drives development for restaurants, retail, helps to really recreate your downtown. We have existing anchors such as Hollywood Music. We have the Dead Horse Music Cantina, which is a 200-seat venue. So, again, we have the pieces to really fill a niche in the Pittsburgh market for a downtown, and the Roxian is that missing link.
Taras, it looks like you have quite a challenge here. The Roxian has been described in a recent Tribune Review article as an eyesore on a street overrun with vacant storefronts. The total estimated price of the theater renovation project, including purchase, has risen from about $1 million in 2007 to nearly $7 million today. So it sounds like a daunting task. How are you going to do this?
It's actually a lot less daunting today than it was, I would say, even a year ago. It's been a learning process. That price tag is actually really been an example of that learning. We have now detailed cost estimates. Macero Corporation has donated their time and talents to help us come up with detailed cost estimates. So we feel we have a much more accurate picture now. We did not have that a few years ago. And again, through working with the League of Historic American Theaters, what we've seen is that small community groups make these type of missteps along the way. These historic theater projects are a lot more complicated than just, to say, a typical historic office building or something like that. There are
– Why is that?
Because the buildings themselves are constructed – again, it's not a, you know, what you would consider a typical office building in construction. It's a matter of having the right people on your team that have experience with historic theaters. So we brought in an architect, really one of the premier architects in historic theaters in Westlake Reed Lasoski out of Cleveland. And again, it's about building that team, building that expertise that helps us to build the partnership that ultimately gets this done. And we think, we feel confident that those pieces are coming together. Again, a big piece of that has been Drusky Entertainment and Brian Drusky coming to us and saying, you know, I need a theater like this. I can put 100 shows a year in here. And again, it just backs up what we're saying in terms of market demand being unmet that we can meet.
How hard has the whole economic downturn been on this effort?
It has – it really kind of stopped us dead in our tracks. We were in the midst of starting renovations. We had had several funding sources dedicated to us that fell apart because you had changes in the economy, changes with government resources and other resources. So that has been in a way, it was a blessing in disguise because, again, it gave us the opportunity to stop, take a look at, again, our team, how we were approaching the project, and realizing that we did not have the expertise in-house to develop a project like this on our own. So it was tremendously beneficial. The other thing that that did happen in the process was the ability to relook at our priorities. And you mentioned the eyesore that Duroxian is. There's no one that it bothers more than me each time I come up to the building and I see the impact that it's having on the street. We are in the midst of doing a detailed Main Street plan as part of this planning effort that shows the kind of the blueprint for what our downtown is going to become. The Roxian is one of the most commanding pieces on that street. And you're right, it's not helping the curb appeal of the Father Ryan Art Center across the street. It's not helping our existing business owners that have invested so much in their buildings. So to address that, we're using our remaining funds to begin renovations on the facade. That's going to start this spring, and that's going to begin to bring the facade of the Roxian back to its original historic makeup and, again, is going to start to create a pretty dramatic change in the streetscape of downtown McKees Rocks.
Mike, we've got just about 30 seconds left, but what's the greatest sense of accomplishment you have with bringing the palace back?
By far, it is when we have people coming into the palace that thank the trust for keeping it, for restoring it, for keeping it, and they share their childhood memories of coming to the Palace Theater. The sense of community is just fantastic. I would say that that's my best feeling.
Mike Langer is president of the Westmoreland Cultural Trust, and Taras Virchek, executive director of the McKees Rock Community Development Corporation, looking to bring the Roxian Theater back to full service. Thanks so much, gentlemen, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Great being here.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. We welcome your comments and story ideas at esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can catch the entire show at wesa.fm or as a podcast. This is 90.5 WESA, Pittsburgh's NPR station. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening.